Before we get into today's episode, I want to let you know about a source of powerful free resources to help you as a parent or grandparent get equipped to invest in the faith of the next generation. Our Next Gen website has been designed to help empower you to navigate tough issues with the young people in your life. At Next Gen, you'll find articles, entertainment reviews from a Christian perspective, parenting stories, helpful parenting guides, and even answers to the tough questions. All these resources are free as you engage on the front line of raising the next generation for Jesus. So why not register today at premierinsight.org/resources to receive free resources from NextGen. That's premierinsight.org/resources. And now it's time for today's podcast.
Good afternoon and welcome along to Unbelievable with me, Justin Brierley, the weekly show that brings Christians and non-Christians together for dialogue and discussion. As part of Faith Explored here on Premier Christian Radio, it's a delight to have you with me, whether you're listening this Saturday afternoon or somewhere around the world via the podcast. If you want to find out how to join the many people who do download the show and enjoy the other resources as well that we offer, do go to the website of the programme, premierchristianradio.com/unbelievable. Links there to this year's Unbelievable Conference on DVD and CD. I'm told it's shipping very soon. If you've placed an order, it will be with you very soon. You can also get hold of the digital download there, of course, right away. And of course, links to Unbelievable, the book, Why After 10 Years of Talking with Atheists, I'm Still a Christian. Got some really exciting developments on that front as well. I just finished recording in a couple of marathon recording sessions the audio book, so that's going to be made available too if you prefer listening via audio. And I'll be down at Creation Fest in this coming week in Cornwall. I'll be there on the 8th and 9th of August, so if you're able to join me there, it's not too late to get along. It's a free event. I'll be talking about that more a little later on in the show. But the book is available now from the website unbelievablebook.co.uk, and I can exclusively reveal that we have special signed copies now available for purchase if you buy them from the Premier website itself rather than from Amazon. So if you would like to get your hands on a signed copy of the book from our website, do go and check that out, unbelievablebook.co.uk. Later on, after Unbelievable, you can hear the Reverend Rose Hudson-Wilkin in conversation with Katie Stock on The Profiled, the most senior black clergywoman in the UK and the chaplain to the Speaker of the House of Commons. So she is really the priest in Parliament. She'll be talking about her faith and life. Do check that out straight after today's edition of Unbelievable. But time to get into today's programme. Let me tell you who we've got on and what we're talking about.
You're unbelievable.
Today on the programme, we're asking, Moses and the Exodus, is it a fact or is it a fable? Now, the story of Moses leading the people of Israel out of slavery in Egypt and towards the Promised Land is probably one of the most pivotal stories in the Old Testament. But is there evidence from archaeology and history outside the Old Testament narratives that Moses actually existed and the Exodus really happened? Critics say it's a myth that sprung up in later Jewish writings and no contemporary records bear it out historically. Well, arguing against that point of view is Ted Wright today on the programme. Ted runs Epic Archaeology, a website which brings together evidence for the historical reliability of both the Old and New Testament through archaeology and historical research. He says that although for good reasons physical evidence for Moses and the Exodus is hard to come by, there are clues to events in Egypt that support the existence of Moses and the Exodus. EpicArchaeology.org is Ted's website. And back on the programme today, after something of a few years hiatus, Robert M. Price, known as Bob, well known as a scholar who's sceptical of the historical basis of Christianity. He's part of the Jesus mythicist movement. In fact, he might tell us about a debate he had with Bart Ehrman, either last year or earlier in the year. He'll tell us. He also believes most of the Old Testament is mythical, including the story of Moses and the Exodus. His recent book, Holy Fable, The Old Testament Undistorted by Faith, makes the case against the historicity of the Old Testament. Robert's got a website as well, robertmprice.mindvender.com. And so we're going to be debating today whether we have evidence or not for the story of Moses and the Exodus. So Ted and Bob, welcome along to the programme today.
Well, thank you for having me on.
Great to be here.
It's great to have you both with me. I'll start with you, Bob, as it's been a little while since you've been on the show. And I did mention in my introduction there that you have actually been sharing a stage not that long ago, I think, with Bart Ehrman, who is not a Christian, but is a believer in the historical Jesus as a scholar. And of course, you go against that view. How did that debate go? Remind me where it was and who it was organized by.
It was sponsored by Mythicist Milwaukee and held in Milwaukee. I think it was last October, but these things run together. I'm pretty sure that's right. And it was, I couldn't tell you really what the composition of the audience was, though I think it must have been mainly agnostics, atheists, and skeptics. I'm not really sure even from the audience participation, but I thoroughly enjoyed meeting Bart. He's really a great guy and a lot of fun. The debate itself I found to be almost the typical around in circles thing, where almost like one of these political debates where you have sometimes a failure to connect, and I was responding to what he had said in his book, Did Jesus Exist? And I felt that, of course, it's in the eye of the beholder, I guess, but I felt that he wasn't really dealing with major objections I had to his approach. He no doubt thought the same thing. And I just tried to show that I felt the burden of proof is on the person that would say that Jesus did exist, because the simple assertion that he did is no more compelling than that Hercules existed. But I always say, you know, there could have been a Jesus. It's not it's certainly not improbable or implausible, but it remains speculative. So I'm not one of these dogmatists who thinks you have to have a doctrine about no Jesus or something. I think that's ridiculous.
I know what you mean when you say sometimes these things can be a bit circular. We've certainly had debates like that on Unbelievable, but maybe we could do a round two at some point and tease things out a bit further on Unbelievable in the future. But in any case, it's good to have you back on, Bob. But this time, obviously, looking at a different area, the historicity of the Old Testament. You've got a new book out, Holy Fable, The Old Testament Undistorted by Faith. Do you want to give us the very brief synopsis of that book?
Well, it's kind of a cross between an Old Testament introduction and an Old Testament commentary. Obviously, in the space of a 350-page book, there's no way to comment on everything in the Old Testament, but I try to go through the major blocks of it, and my goal is to say this is what seems likely to me about the origin and the historical veracity, but also what the teaching is, and this is some of the great treasures in it. And I'm pointedly not attacking the Bible, and indeed my view is pretty much that it's like being a scholar of Homer. You don't have to hate Homer to realize that there wasn't an Achilles. There wasn't a Trojan War in all probability, or at least the things recorded of it didn't happen. And if you're a classicist, you don't want people to take it literally. Not that there are hardly any people who do, but you want to clarify things.
Yeah. I appreciate that you don't come to this sort of with an axe to grind against religion per se, because I know that you, even as an atheist, you still, you know, attend church and get something out of religious rituals every so often, don't you?
Yes, and I love the Bible. I bristle at what I regard as a kind of straitjacketing of the Bible by forcing it to be interpreted in line with dogmas of infallibility and so on. I think that cheats the Bible, paradoxically enough. So I'm a big Bible fan, and you know, not some village atheist spouting off against it.
We'll hear you on this particular issue, making your case for or against, well, against really, Moses and the Exodus. And we're going to do that, of course, with my other guest today on the show. This is the show that brings Christians and non-Christians together, of course. And our Christian on the show today is Ted Wright from the Epic Archaeology website. Ted, welcome along to the program.
Justin, thank you for having me on.
It's great to have you. So Lovely to meet you. And just describe for us briefly, if you would, how you got into this passion for archaeology and putting it together with the Old and New Testament.
That's a great question. Actually, it goes back to my undergraduate days when I was getting my degree in archaeology. And as you know, I grew up in the church, but didn't really have a lot of information about where the Bible came from or any of the historical questions. And as I began to take these classes in archaeology and history, some of my professors were saying that these events did not happen. And so that sort of disturbed me as a Christian. I was kind of like, well, if they didn't happen, then why am I a Christian? So I began to kind of sort of started me on my lifelong quest to discover if, in fact, there is any evidence historically for the Bible and these biblical stories. And two of the stories in particular that have intrigued me from very early age all the way to today is, of course, the story of the Exodus and Moses and the story of Noah and the Ark. So that sort of put me on a quest, and went ahead and got my degree in archaeology and then in apologetics as well, and studied under Norm Geisler and some other apologists as well. I got to have some interactions with Dr. John Lennox. I'm not sure if you've had him on the show.
Many times, of course, many times.
Yes, it's great. He's a gentleman and a scholar.
Yes, yes.
And then, of course, I don't know if you know, I also worked for crossexamined.org for a number of years with Frank Turek, who is also a very good friend of mine as well.
And also a recent guest on this program. So that's kind of how you got into the whole area. So your experience in academia was casting a lot of doubt on the historicity of, I guess, both the New and Old Testament. Now, we've done shows that dig into the historicity of the New Testament many times on this program. Not so much the Old Testament, though. In fact, this may be the very first time on Unbelievable in our 11 and a half years where we've really sat down and debated the historicity of the Old Testament. I guess for most Christians, obviously, the New Testament is primary at some level in terms of whether Jesus existed and we can trust what he did and said and so on is recorded about him. But I guess it's, for you, very important that we also have that kind of confidence in the Old Testament, too.
Absolutely. I've actually taught the Old Testament for about 13 years, and as an undergrad and graduate class. And one of the ways that I would tell my students is that, and you're right, we do in the New Testament, especially New Testament apologists and apologists in general, like, you know, Mike Lacona and Dr. Gary Habermas and others. And we focus on the New Testament and the reliability of the New Testament text. But I would put it this way, that if you think of it as a tree, think of the whole Bible, Old and New Testament, as a tree. You have, of course, you've got the branches and the leaves and all the things on the top. But at the bottom of the tree, you have the roots. And I would argue that the tree with all of the leaves and the fruit and the branches really don't make sense. In fact, they can't really have any life apart from the roots. The roots are what are in the ground, and they bring the life and the nourishment to the leaves. So that's kind of how I see the Old Testament. So it's, to me, it's just as important as defending the New Testament.
Well, there are many areas that we could, you know, open up for discussion on that front, and lots of interesting finds over recent decades that sort of, in your view, corroborate and confirm the Old Testament. But we're going to focus today on Moses and the Exodus in particular. So do you want to just spell out what commonly is the, if you like, skeptical position on this? And again, briefly, and we'll obviously develop it in the course of the program, what your response to it is.
Are you asking me the skeptical? Okay.
Yeah. Well, yeah. Unless we could. Well, that's a really good point, actually. Why don't we ask the skeptic who's with us for the skeptical position? And before we do that, let me just say, if you're listening and you would like to get in touch about today's show, why not email me, unbelievable@premier.org.uk. Be delighted to hear from you. You can also Facebook me, tweet me as well, @unbelievablejb for the Twitter, facebook.com/unbelievablejb is the place to go for Facebook. All of those addresses and ways to get in contact available from today's program on the website. That's premierchristianradio.com/unbelievable. You can find links, of course, there to the podcast, to further resources, to the Unbelievable DVD and digital download as well from this year's conference, featuring John Lennox, of course, who we just heard mentioned. And, of course, Unbelievable, the book too. Why I'm still a Christian after all these years of hosting dialogues between Christians and skeptics. So that's the ways to get in touch. Do hope you enjoy today's show.
Unbelievable with Justin Brierley.
So we're debating today, Moses and the Exodus, fact or fable. Ted Wright, who from Epic Archaeology is our Christian guest. Robert Price, or Bob Price as he's often known, is a scholar skeptical of the historical basis of Christianity and indeed the story of Moses and the Exodus. So Bob, it seems, as Ted sort of said there, fair to give you the opportunity to outline the case against Moses and the Exodus as a fact. Why do you believe it is a fable?
One thing, the whole approach known as Old Testament minimalism figures directly into this, and it's based on a paradigm shift in biblical archaeology. In fact, a lot of these people like Thomas L. Thompson, Niels Peter Lemke, and others don't even really want to use that term anymore. They say that biblical archaeology, quote-unquote, began and continued as a sub-discipline of apologetics, and the focus really was on the Bible, not whatever we can find archaeologically, and that the Albright School, William Foxwell Albright and his disciples, G. Ernest Wright, etc., these guys were pursuing a program similar in many ways to that of Constantine's mother, who sent people out to the Holy Land to find the sites mentioned in the Bible, really in the life of Jesus, Golgotha and the empty tomb and Bethlehem and so forth. And it was like, it's out there, go find it. And so they came up with sites that could plausibly be identified with it. And so that's where Jesus was born. That's where he died. That's where he rose, and so on and so on. Whereas what I call the pin the tail on the Bible approach, you've got in mind what you want to find or prove. And then if there's something that might be passable to identify with it, well, then that's it. We're christening that, the empty tomb, Golgotha, etc. Whereas Thompson and these others say, let's just get that out of our heads for the moment and try to be as inductive as we can with the data on the ground. Well, when it comes to Moses and the Exodus, you start, at least this is my understanding of the minimalist approach and result, you find no evidence of what you must find evidence of if these stories are true, in terms of a mass population movement through the Sinai Desert. But I think there are like three historical favorite theories as to the route taken, but whichever one you prefer, there is simply is no evidence of it, and there would have to be. And so this is in a time when we can use infrared technology to discover old caravan routes by infrared detection and so on. But this, we don't find any evidence of. And so what are you going to argue, that Satan, after he got done planting the fake dinosaur bones, sent demons out with vacuum cleaners to get rid of the evidence of a million people and a huge herd of cattle and all that traipsing through the desert? It just seems like it's very difficult to see how there could be, you know, what would have happened to the evidence. And then beyond that, I mean, an older approach that I think is still compatible. In fact, I wrote a little book recently called Moses and Minimalism, Fiction versus Form Criticism in the Old Testament. Form criticism, pioneered by Hermann Gunkel and others, showed that virtually every Moses story, and including the major pieces of the stories of the plagues and all of that, can readily be explained and persuasively understood as an etiology, like a mythic origin story for various ceremonies, why certain holy places are holy, because Moses slept here, so to speak, why certain things have certain names, Massa and Meribah and so on. What does that mean? Well, gee, maybe why would they name a place after bitterness and contention? Well, maybe Moses had a problem with certain ingrates there and so on and so on. and just why certain geological features are as they are, and name origins, all sorts of things, whereas there seems to be no real biographical evidence about Moses. Most of it seems to be borrowed from the earlier legends of Jacob, or even common myth themes like the survival of the persecuted infant, very similar to that of Theseus, especially similar to that of Sargon, and so on. And when these things are so readily paralleled by myths and legends, so readily explained by literary criticism, and when there is no hard evidence on the ground, it just seems superfluous to insist that there was this character.
When do you think it's likely, in your view, that the Moses story kind of was officially kind of written down and started to be passed down as sort of a historical thing in Jewish culture?
Hard to say. I don't know exactly where I'd put the marker on that, but I think the story in its present form, woven from three different accounts, J, E, and P, probably is pretty darn late from the Hellenistic or Persian period, even. One thing that has surprised and shocked me, even as an Old Testament critic, quote-unquote, is the arguments that the Old Testament is very, very late, and but I find it pretty plausible and convincing.
Okay.
Hard to say, maybe not that ancient.
Let's pass the baton over at this point, and we needed a little time there to spell out your case, both against the Exodus and Moses himself, Bob, so thank you. Ted, where do you want to begin, with Moses or the Exodus?
Let's begin with Moses and the Exodus, just kind of as a general overview.
Okay, go ahead.
So I would say that there's actually a positive case for Moses and the Exodus, and not based on conjecture, not based even just on, you know, guesswork, but it's based on chronology, internal evidence within the text itself, and then external evidence in the Egyptian record, in Egypt itself. And so I'll begin with chronology. And so in chronology, is, as Edwin Thiel said, is the backbone of history. And I don't know if, Justin, if you remember this, of course, many people are aware of the great Indiana Jones movie, The Raiders of the Lost Ark. And so in the 1981 movie, Indy and his sidekick Sala have located where they believe the Ark of the Covenant is buried. And of course, the Nazis are also looking for the Ark as well. And so Sala lowers Indy into the Well of the Souls, and they discover that the Nazis are digging in the wrong place. Well, that's the way it is with many, many liberal scholars today who look for evidence of the Exodus, but they're looking in the wrong time. They're looking in the wrong chronological time frame. And so this brings us to the issue of chronology. And Edwin Thiel was a scholar back in the 1950s, and he published a groundbreaking book titled The Mysterious Numbers of the Hebrew Kings, where Thiel set out to accurately reconcile the reigns of the Hebrew kings mentioned in the Old Testament with their neighboring Near Eastern cultures. And the opening words of Thiel's book are worth pondering. He says that chronology is the backbone of history, and absolute chronology is the fixed core around which the events of a nation must be correctly grouped before they may assume their exact positions in history and before their mutual relationships may be properly understood. Without exact chronology, there can be no exact history. Until a correct chronology of a nation has been established, the events of that nation cannot be correctly integrated into the events of the neighboring states. If history is to be true in exact science, then it is of fundamental importance to reconstruct a sound chronological framework about which may be fitted the events of states and the international world, end quote. So this issue of chronology is vitally important for discovering the Exodus. And so so what I want to do is to talk about three dating methods in which archaeologists date sites or date archaeology, archaeological sites or events. And now this subject itself could be a whole discussion by itself, but I just want to just briefly mention it here.
Go ahead.
And I'm going to mention four. And then I'll mention an additional one just so people will kind of know what they are. The first one is what we call historical synchronisms, and I'll explain what that is in just a moment. And the second one is what is called, an archaeologist call it, ceramic typology, or dating by pottery. Very, very large in archaeology, not just in the Near East, but also in Greece and other places as well. And then number three, dating by carbon 14. Number four, something called numismatics, which is dating by coins, which we know came into use during the Persian period around 550 BC. And then the last method that I'll just mention in passing is something called archaeoastronomy, or the use of astronomical events for dating. The reason why archaeoastronomy is now an important dating method is because of the work of the German astronomer Johannes Kepler. In 1609, he published his Laws of Planetary Motion. So what that means, sort of just for lay people, why that's important is that now, because of Kepler's laws, we can actually punch in a date. Like, there are software programs now which you can punch in a date, you can see what the sky looked like. So what that means is that if we have a historical event that records an astronomical event or a historical record, then we can go back in the astronomy and see what that event was and then give it a date. So I hope that makes sense.
Yeah, sure.
But I want to really talk about historical synchronisms, because that's really where the bread and butter is. So a historical synchronism is a fixed date that we can attach to a biblical event in which there is a direct archaeological link to that event by an artifact or an inscription. For example, I'll give you one example of what we called a historical synchronism. One is the destruction of Jerusalem by the Babylonians in 586 BC. And I'm pretty sure that Bob would agree that that's a pretty well historically verified fact. 586 BC, the Babylonians came in to Jerusalem. So now we know it wouldn't be hard to date an Iron Age 2C destruction level in Jerusalem or in the ancient biblical site of Tel Lachish to 586 BC. So this is what would be a historical synchronism. So we've got a pretty firm date on that event. Another event, in fact, that actually figures into the dating of the Exodus, and this is what we'll talk about more later, but I just want to mention it now, is the construction of Solomon's Temple, in which this is another date in which most ancient Near Eastern archaeologists are pretty unanimous on, even those who are skeptical of the biblical text. And they believe that that date is around 966 BC. So the reason why this date is important for the dating of the Exodus is because in the internal evidence of the text itself, the Old Testament, in 1 Kings chapter 6, verse 1, the text states that in the 480th year after the people of Israel came out of the land of Egypt, in the fourth year of Solomon's reign over Israel, in the month of Ziv, which is the second month, he began to build the house of the Lord. So if we add 480 years to 966 BC, then this would place the Exodus at 1446 BC, which is, as many people who follow this know, that that's the early date of the Exodus, 1446 BC. This would place the Exodus during the Egyptian 18th dynasty. Most liberal scholars place the Exodus in the 14th or 15th century, around the time of Ramses II. And they say, well, we look for evidence of the Exodus, and there's none there. Well, yeah, of course it's not going to be there.
So just to be clear here, Ted, most liberal scholars date the Exodus around 1200 BC. That's the sort of Ramses II time. But you think there's good evidence that it was actually earlier than that, 1446 BC, because of this clue from scripture that you believe is
right. And this is just the beginning point, and we can test to see, it may or may not be right, but let's go with it and see what see if the evidence bear it out.
Let's take a quick pause there, and we'll let you continue to develop your case on the other side of a quick break. This is unbelievable. Today, we're having to, dig in a little bit, both metaphorically and literally, when it comes to archaeology at least, to Moses and the Exodus. That's our debate today on the program between my Christian guest Ted Wright and my atheist guest Robert Price. We're asking, was it a fact or a fable? We'll continue to hear from Ted Wright as to why he believes archaeology does support the story of Moses and the Exodus in the Old Testament. And Bob, of course, will respond in due course. This is the show that brings different voices together for conversations that matter every week. Unbelievable. We'll be back in just a mo.
Believers and non-believers will all be helped, says Tim Keller. A wonderfully clear and accessible case for Christianity. From a man who has hosted many of the world's most prominent skeptics and atheists, says Andrew Wilson. Beautifully written, brilliantly argued, will thrill and challenge, says R.T. Kendall. Unbelievable, the book by Justin Brierley. Download a free chapter and find out how it can help you make the case for Christ. Unbelievablebook.co.uk.
You're listening to Unbelievable on Premier Christian Radio.
Great to have you with me on Unbelievable today. This is the show that brings Christians and non-Christians together for dialogue and debate every week. And if you want to find more of them, get them regularly sent to your iPod or whatever device you listen to your podcast via, do check out the website where you can find links to the iTunes and other ways to listen via the podcast. premierchristianradio.com/unbelievable. Don't forget that straight after Unbelievable today, you can hear The Profile, another guest talking about their walk of faith and life between 4 and 5 this afternoon. We'll hear some of your feedback as well towards the end of today's show. Moses and the Exodus, fact or fable, we're asking. The story of Moses leading the people of Israel out of slavery in Egypt and towards the Promised Land is one of the most pivotal stories, of course, in the Old Testament. But is there actually evidence from archaeology and history outside those Old Testament narratives that Moses really did exist and the Exodus really happened? Well, a critic joins us on the show today. Robert Price, known as Bob, is a scholar skeptical of the entire historical basis of Christianity, but certainly believes most of the Old Testament is mythical. His recent book, Holy Fable, The Old Testament Undistorted by Faith, makes the case against the historicity of the Old Testament. Speaking in favour today of the Moses and the Exodus, and indeed that archaeology does corroborate and confirm the Old and New Testament, Ted Wright of Epic Archaeology joins us. And he's continuing to make his case for the earlier dating of the Exodus. He explained why he believes that we should see the Exodus as occurring at an earlier date than many people give it credit for. And you're about to kind of develop on the back of that, I think, Ted, why then, if we look at the events and people involved at that time, we might see some clues that something pretty interesting and major did happen that you might look a little bit like something like the Exodus. So do you want to just continue to spell this out before Bob comes back?
Yes, thank you, Justin. So let me just say that before I begin, to kind of continue to build the case here, that just a general statement about archaeology. Archaeology is an inductive science. And of course, no matter what you're dealing with, whether it's Moses in Egypt or whether you're dealing with New Testament archaeology, as an inductive science, there's nothing that's 100% absolute provable in archaeology. But we do build our case, and we either have a strong case or a weak case. And admittedly, you know, in the past several years or decades, the case for Moses in Egypt and the Exodus has been fairly weak at best. But there's been some smattering of evidence here and there. But there are some new evidence that's come out recently that is just very remarkable. But I still think there's a very strong case that we can believe the biblical account of Moses and the Exodus. And so I'll kind of continue on, Justin, by talking about just earlier we mentioned those three lines of evidence in which I think we can look at as providing a positive case for Moses existence in the Exodus as well. And so I'll begin with the internal evidence and just kind of touch on that briefly, and then I'll talk about the external evidence. In the book of Acts, in the New Testament book of Acts, chapter 7, verse 22, at the very end of that passage, the writer of Acts says that Moses was a man educated in all the learning of the Egyptians, and he was a man of power and word and deed. So just taking that at face value, that if Moses, of course, if we just kind of give the text the benefit of the doubt and say, okay, let's say that Moses was a man that was educated as an Egyptian. Now, you would expect to find internal evidence in the text itself of someone who lived in Egypt, someone who knew Egyptian culture, someone who knew Egyptian religion. So the question is, do we find that? Absolutely, we find it in droves. And of course, this would not be possible without the work, the groundbreaking work of the French scholar Champollion, who, of course, didn't discover the Rosetta Stone. That was by Napoleon Bonaparte's troops. One, in fact, in particular, Lieutenant Bouchard, who in 1799 discovered the Rosetta Stone. It wasn't until years later, until Champollion, deciphered the Rosetta Stone. And this is important for Egyptology and also for archaeology in the fact that it unlocked hieroglyphics. And now we can read the hieroglyphics of the pyramids and also many of the temples and inscriptions that we find in Egypt. So that being said, scholars begin to decipher many of these texts, these Egyptian texts, that provide insight into the biblical text indirectly because they show that whoever wrote the Exodus had an intimate knowledge of Egyptian culture. I'll give you a couple of examples. One example would be what is called the serpent motif. And many people are aware. You can just kind of picture it in your mind. If you see a picture of King Tut, you know that famous picture of King Tut, the gold burial mask. Mm. And on the crown of King Tut, there's a snake that's coming off of the crown of King Tut. And in any Egyptian, you know, mummy or mask that you see the snake figured very largely in Egyptian symbolism. Well, as it turns out, the snake is actually one of the chief gods of Egypt. Of course, Egypt had many gods, but the snake was one of the primary gods because it represented what we call Lower Egypt, which was in the north in the Nile Delta. And so when Moses goes before Pharaoh and he throws his staff down, it literally turns into a snake, which was sort of a symbol of that. It was a, it was basically saying that God is in absolute control. And of course, you know, the Pharaoh's magicians threw their staff down and it became a snake as well. But then Moses' staff consumed their staff, their snakes as well. So this is sort of a polemic. And then, of course, you look at all of the plagues, all the 10 plagues, the Nile turning into blood, the frogs, the gnats, the flies, the plague of cattle, the boils. Every single plague, all 10 plagues, actually confronted or at least opposed an Egyptian deity. Each of these, like the Nile turning to blood, there were at least three gods that were supposed to be able to protect the Nile: Khnum, Hapi, and Osiris. And of course, the frogs was the god Hekt,
yeah,
which is the god of resurrection.
And is there a kind of, is the link here kind of in the way that Borkum's work has helped to, as many people would see, corroborate the New Testament, because he's shown that the names used in the New Testament documents corroborate with the details, you know, what we know of the names independently that would have existed at the time, and would have been hard to make up that kind of correlation written at a later time in a different place. And similarly, this, it would be very hard for a later Jewish writer to make up and get right the details you're talking about in terms of the Egyptian culture several hundred years before.
Right. And that's just the tip of the iceberg, Jeff. You are exactly correct. That's just the tip of the iceberg. And then the one that really that I think is most important, there's just so much, it's just hard to cram it all in just this radio interview. But one more that I'll mention that's very powerful to me, at least in my estimation, is the heart issue. And of course, this comes from something called the Egyptian Book of the Dead, in particular, something called the Ani Papyrus. And there's actually a papyrus scene in which you have the Egyptian god Anubis, who is weighing a scale balance, and on the right hand of the scale, there's a feather, the hieroglyphic feather of something called Ma'at in Hebrew, in Egyptian, and it symbolizes truth, it symbolizes righteousness, it symbolizes goodness. On the left side of the scale is the heart. So what happened in the afterlife is the Pharaoh would die. Of course, they would take all of his entrails out, but his heart would be left in the body. And over the mummified remains of the Pharaoh, they would place either one of two items. They would place something called a heart amulet. And it would be either the amulet shaped like a heart, or it would be a scarab. And the scarab actually contained a spell from the Egyptian Book of the Dead. And to protect the heart, to soften the heart. And in each of the 10 plagues, it says, beginning in Exodus chapter 8, in 10 times it says, Pharaoh hardened his heart, Pharaoh hardened his heart, or God hardened Pharaoh's heart. Mm. So the issue here is the hardening of the heart is not a good thing. And in the Hebrew, it's actually a building of the hardening. So the hardening starts out sort of kind of hard, and then it sort of, plagues continue to go forward, the heart gets so hard that it's going to be condemned in the afterlife. Whoever's writing this would have known this.
It's all indicative, in your view, of someone who's familiar with the customs and nature and culture of that time and place. I feel we should bring Bob in at this point, because I know there's much more that you want to build around in your case here. We haven't even got to the issue of Amenhotep II versus Ramesses and so on, in terms of who was actually the pharaoh in question in the story of Moses. But we will come to that, hopefully. But Bob, I feel we should give you a chance to respond at this point to some of these, what has been described here by Ted as internal evidences. When it comes to the story of Moses and the Exodus, there's all kinds of cultural detail about ancient Egypt, which would not have kind of been accessible really to someone else writing it at some point later in time in a different time and place and culture. So what's your general response to that?
Well, I don't buy that, because the religion of Isis and Osiris was very popular all over the Hellenistic world for centuries. It's not like they would have had to undertake expeditions to find out this stuff. And it seems to me there is more evidence that whoever wrote this was not familiar with the conditions involved. For instance, K.A. Kitchen against the documentary hypothesis, the fusion of J.E. and P. to give us the narrative that, if you divide it up, you ruin the sequence of plagues which correspond to natural phenomena connected to the flooding of the Nile every year. One thing followed another, the red microscopic critters, the flagella, were swept down the river, and they were followed by frogs and so on, and there were too many of them for the environment, so they died, and their rotting carcasses created the diseases that killed the cattle and so on. Well, what he fails to notice is that the writer clearly views these things as extraordinary miracles, whereas, as Kitchen himself admits, everybody back then who was in Egypt would have known, no, this stuff happens all the time. Likewise with the manna in the desert. People point to that and say, oh, you could still find manna over there. That's right, and it seems like the writers of Exodus didn't realize that. They thought this was like the bread of angels, etc. And so I am not that persuaded by that. I think that many, many, many people in the ancient world knew about the Egyptian gods. How could they not? Egypt was so dominant, even in Palestine, for a couple of thousand years. And I get the impression that Ted is assuming Mosaic authorship of the Pentateuch. And that is really problematic. If you want to talk about textual evidence, you have to explain why they're all the different styles segregated into, you can split up individual stories and show how they're coherent pieces by themselves, but together they create contradictions. Like, how many times did the cattle get killed in the plagues? Three times. What are they? They're like super cows or something, or the cows rose from the dead or something. It just makes sense as different mythical narratives scotch taped together. And the notion that you can find authentic material about ancient Egypt, really, that's arguing that because the movies have accurate stuff about the Nazis in, like, for instance, Captain America, the first Avenger. Well, I guess that proved that Cap and the Red Skull really existed. No, it doesn't. And if you're dealing with stories where Moses is turning sticks into snakes, I mean, that means you're begging the whole question. You can't take that as foundational data. And I just think this has the... admittedly, you know, we press for time and there's only so much you can explain, but if you're saying that, then this is simply apologetics, trying to find some way to take these stories as literal history when it just seems obvious
Let's toss it back to Ted at that point, Ted. I mean, we need to deal with that claim that it's effectively apologetics dressed up as serious archaeology. But, I mean, generally, Bob's point there is, you know, people would have been familiar with Egyptian culture, with Egyptian gods in the ancient world. They didn't have to have done a whole bunch of archaeology to know what we know today about it. And generally, you know, there are these other naturalistic explanations for why the plagues might have been described in that way. But and then you've got the way that the text all hangs together. And as far as Bob can see, it comes from three different sources. That kind of has major problems for it being, you know, written by Moses and so on. So a lot of stuff to respond to there. Where do you want to begin?
There's a lot to respond to. So let me begin with the JEDP. I'm just kind of curious, Bob, you know, you, from one hand, you say you're a minimalist, and then the other hand, you say you follow the JEDP. So I'm kind of confused, but either view, there are problems. This begin with a JEDP. That is such an old theory. It dates back to Wellhausen, even before that. And it's just sort of outdated and even Robert Alter, who is not a conservative scholar, argues for the unity of the text. Just because the writer of the Old Testament, the Pentateuch, uses different names for God, doesn't necessarily mean that it's four or three independent writers. Just like you as a writer, Bob, can use different names in different ways in different genres. There's no reason to say that the writer of the Old Testament.
I can hear Bob wanting to interject. Bob, what did you want to say?
There's loads more. There are certain literary styles. There are different conceptions of God. God is and of the patriarchs and the heroes. In J, there it's more salty and entertaining. E has some of the same stories, but dresses up the characters so that Abraham isn't just a liar about his wife and his sister. It's sort of true in E, whereas it wasn't. In J, he has no compunction about kicking Hagar out into the street, but in E, God has to convince him to do it, and so on down the line. In the flood story, it abounds in contradictions. How long did the flood last?
Well, let's not
seven pairs.
And then
the thing is, you can dissect the story according to these things, and they all match. The style of P is different. The names of God that P uses different, El Shaddai and so on. And the data fits without contradiction once you split it up into two. And it's just not true to say this is passé.
Okay, let's bring Ted back in. Ted, but your view is that the kind of theory that Bob is attached to there is one that's a bit outdated and has been, in your view, been surpassed.
Well, I mean, most Old Testament scholars today hold to some form of JEDP, and earlier in the program, you asked, you know, what was the liberal view or what was the skeptical view of the Old Testament? I would answer it this way, and of course, Bob, you know, gave his answer. There are different gradations of skepticism of the Old Testament. Of course, that began with Wellhausen and many of these scholars, the German scholars, back in the late 19th century, early 20th century, and then now you have Bob, sort of the view that he holds to, which is the biblical minimalist view, which comes from Thomas Thompson, Niles Peter Lemke, and then Redford and others, who basically – it's really just postmodern philosophy in the Old Testament. And it's really grounded on the philosophy of Martin Heidegger, and really not even Heidegger, really his students, postmodern like Michel Foucault and others. So there are some fundamental – problems with the biblical minimalist camp. In fact, Kenneth Kitchen actually articulated this in his book on the reliability of the Old Testament, and I just want to read a couple of these. I'll just read three. He actually lists six of these, and these are the principles in which the biblical minimalist school is built, but their philosophy. I'll just read the first three. Number one, the author's intention is an illusion created by the readers. Number two, the text is an interpretable entity independent of its author. Number three, language is infinitely unstable and meaning is always deferrable. Well, if those are true, if those three statements are true, and if the Thomas Thompson and Bob and others are going to hold to that as their principle of interpreting a text, then why should we believe anything they ever say? I mean, they don't believe that about their own books, but yet they apply that to the biblical text. Why is that? If language is an interpretable entity independent of its writer, then no rational discourse would be possible at all. So I would just go back to, and I think
we should move beyond the text, though. I'm aware of time, and that we want to certainly get to some of the other elements. We'll agree to disagree on that one.
Okay.
You obviously believe there's good evidence for the unity of the text and so on, and its mosaic heritage and so on. But the other issue that Bob said was, you know, the fact that there is this internal consistency you claim in Book of Exodus. People knew about, you know, the Egyptian gods,
sure,
and that kind of thing. It could have been written down at a different time, place. It's not impossible by any means.
Oh, absolutely. Egyptian religion was very popular throughout the Roman world, but the specifics that we find in the Exodus text or in the text of the Old Testament is much more specific than just Osiris and Isis and things like that. These are very generalisms. But the specifics are in the text itself about the hardening of the heart. Mm. How would they have known about the hardening of the heart in the Egyptian Book of the Dead that was only known about by Egyptian priests, not the general public that you see?
Okay.
And that's just the beginning. But I'd really like to go, just if I could, to talking about the Pharaoh of the Exodus.
Yes, I think that's really important. We dig that out now. We've got about 6 minutes in this section, and we have another 10 or 15 minutes in the next. So we should definitely focus on this now. Do your best at encapsulating this as briefly as you can for me, Ted.
Okay. All right. So earlier we talked about chronology, and we talked about if the Exodus occurred in 1446, there are two primary candidates then for the Pharaoh of the Exodus. And one really stands out in particular, and I'll just go ahead and cut to the chase. And people pronounce his name differently. Justin, you may have a different pronunciation, but I call him Amenhotep II. It certainly seems like he is the Pharaoh of the Exodus. His father was a Pharaoh called Tutmosis III. And Tutmosis III was considered to be the Napoleon of Egypt. Now, what's interesting about Amenhotep II, there are many things that actually line up with him actually being the Pharaoh of the Exodus. Now, for many years, an ancient Egyptian city in the Nile Delta called Avaris has actually been excavated by an Austrian archaeologist named Manfred B. Tack. And residence of Amenhotep II. This is the location of his chariot forces and also his military garrisons that were in the Sinai, and also because this was a branch of the Nile, provided access to the Mediterranean. So it's a very well excavated, very well known about place. It shows evidence of Asiatic Semitic habitation for hundreds of years before his reign. Now, what's something that's interesting happens is in the ninth year of Amenhotep II's reign, the layer in which Manfred B. Tack excavated that actually has the place where they would actually create weapons and where B. Tack believes that there were military garrisons that were based, it literally just goes blank. Now, not only that, but also his he orders the overthrow of many of the Egyptian priests in that same year. So something happened in the ninth year of the reign of Amenhotep II that caused him to overturn, in particular, the god Amun-Ra. Now, why is that significant is that this was the national religion of his father. In fact, his father, Tutmosis III, we have evidence of this in many Egyptian inscriptions, he would actually give homage to Amun-Ra for giving him military victories. In fact, he would go into Asia and into Mesopotamia. They would have these military campaigns in which Tutmosis III would go into these places. He would gather slaves. He would do these military conquests, and he would come back and give all these praises to Amun-Ra. And during the first 8 years of Amenhotep II's reign, he was following in his father's footsteps. So he was a very militarily minded pharaoh. But something happened, and it really the evidence in the Egyptian records sort of goes blank in the ninth year of the reign of Amenhotep II. And now, what's also interesting is that his firstborn son does not succeed him as pharaoh, and nor was he the firstborn son, because of course, the tenth plague was the death of the firstborn. But it was his second or third son, a pharaoh by the name of Tutmosis IV, who actually succeeded him as the pharaoh. Who followed Amenhotep II. And the reason why we know this is because of the dream stela at the base of the Great Sphinx near Memphis, Egypt. There's one other little bit of evidence that I also want to bring out as well, and this is a very recent evidence that's come out of the Sinai Peninsula at a place called Serabit El Khadim, which is actually a copper mine. One of my colleagues at Associates of Biblical Research, a scholar by the name of Dr. Douglas Petrovich, has actually discovered inscriptions containing the names of Hebrews. In fact, it says that there were six Hebrews from Bethel that came into Egypt. And he also, in one of the inscriptions in the Sinai, discovered the name of Moses. And the literal inscription says this. It says, our bound servitude lingered, then Moses provoked astonishment. That's literally what the text says. And this is found in the Egyptian Sinai. And Dr. Petrovich also believes, and I know it's a very controversial theory and it's still being debated among scholars today, is that the first consonantal language is actually Hebrew. So it's a very exciting discovery.
That's an enormous amount, really. I mean, this is fascinating stuff. I could talk about this all day, to be honest. But we must hear from Bob again, and we'll do that on the other side of a break. But just to summarise there, you're making the claim that if we actually get the dating correct, and in your view, we're talking about Amenhotep II, I think I'm pronouncing that right, there's evidence that in the ninth year, he abandoned his military outpost and overthrew the Egyptian god Amon-Ra, and his eldest son died. And all of that, for you, fits very well with the story of the Moses and the Exodus, because obviously that's what you might expect in terms of the grand events described there, and of course the death of the firstborn. Interesting stuff. We will we'll come back with Bob, our skeptic today, Bob Price, talking about Moses and the Exodus, fact or fable. You're listening to Unbelievable. We're going to continue to debate this for another 10 or 15 minutes in the next section of today's show.
If you want to have a massive reason why human beings are special, here it is. God became one.
We can be part of God's plan to bring hope to a hopeless generation.
We're living in an exciting time to be a follower of Jesus. The golden age of Christianity, ladies and gentlemen.
We live in a universe that has a story that is ultimately about love.
There's a God-shaped hole in the heart of every person. It can only be filled by God, made known through Jesus Christ.
Hear the world's leading Christian thinkers make the case for Christ at Unbelievable, the Conference 2017. Now available not only on DVD, but also as a digital download. Order online at premier.org.uk/shop.
Welcome back to the final part of this week's Unbelievable, the show that brings Christians and non-Christians together for dialogue and debate. If you want to get in touch about anything you hear on the show today, I do encourage you to send in your feedback. You can email unbelievable@premier.org.uk. Get in touch with us via our social media. You can follow me on Twitter @UnbelievableJB, facebook.com/UnbelievableJB for the Facebook site of the page. And of course, you're welcome to find us online as well at the webpage. Leave your comments there underneath today's programme. Check out the other things we offer in terms of resources of the Unbelievable Conference on DVD and CD and digital download. Also, of course, links there to the book as well, or you can go straight to unbelievablebook.co.uk. But all those links available from the show page, premierchristianradio.com/unbelievable. So we'll be back into the final part of the discussion on the Old Testament and the historical reliability of the stories from archaeology and so on in a moment's time. Next week, plan is to air the conversation I'm going to be having on the stage of Creation Fest this coming week. And I'm going to be joined by Andy Bannister, who's no stranger to this show, Christian thinker and apologist, and Mark Preedy of Cornwall Humanist. So he's local to the area where Creation Fest is taking place. We're going to be airing the discussion that I'll be chairing between them. Why I'm a Christian, why I am a humanist is the topic of the conversation. Again, if you want to join me down at Creation Fest, it's not too late to get along there. It's completely free of charge. You just have to sort out your own accommodation. It's down in Wadebridge in Cornwall. It's already begun, but I'll be talking about my book in the afternoon on Tuesday the 8th of August, and then the following day, Wednesday the 9th, I'll be chairing this live stage version of Unbelievable with the audience there at Creation Fest. So really looking forward to that. Do come and say hello if you're an Unbelievable listener and you're down at Creation Fest this coming week. So that's next week's programme. Also some other great programmes lined up for over the summer. I've got some real treats in store for you. Now, just recently, I asked for your questions for Alvin Plantinga, the well-known Christian philosopher who's been nominated for the Templeton Prize this year. Got to sit down and have that conversation with him. Really interesting. And you will hear that in September, nearer to the date of the Templeton Award prize giving. So that's one to look out for in the future. The next Q&A we do, and we've done a few of these this year actually with significant personalities, is actually going to be with historian Rodney Stark. That's the next one I'm recording. He's the author of books such as The Rise of Christianity, and he's a very significant voice in terms of charting the influence of Christianity historically. So if that's your bag and you'd like to ask Rodney Stark a question when I come to record with him, do send them in, as usual, to unbelievable@premier.org.uk. Be interested to hear from you and let me know what your question is, or tweet me, or send it in via Facebook. You've got a little time to send those in. I'll need those questions by Friday the 8th of September. We've got some feedback coming up soon on the recent shows we've done on science and faith. Also, some more of your comments about why you listen to Unbelievable. Right now, time to get into the final part of today's discussion.
You're listening to Unbelievable on Premier Christian Radio.
Well, we're trying to wrap up what is a huge area, and perhaps we'll need a second bite of the cherry on this one, because we're trying to distill massive archaeological claims and finds and theories and debates into, as usual, a one-hour discussion here on Unbelievable. We're talking about Moses and the Exodus today. Fact or fable? My Christian guest Ted Wright runs Epic Archaeology. Says that although for good reasons physical evidence of Moses and the Exodus is hard to come by, there are clues to the events in Egypt that support the existence of Moses and the Exodus. And in the last section of the programme, he was making the case that if it was the case that these events happened at the time of Amenhotep II, there are these clues that something major happened that caused him to abandon his military outposts, overthrow the Egyptian gods, and indeed suggest that his eldest son died. It all fits with the story of Moses and the Exodus. Robert M. Price is a scholar, skeptical of the historical basis of Christianity, also thinks most of the Old Testament is mythical, and he's got a book out on that, Holy Fable. Bob, I want to make sure we give you time to respond now in this section of the show. I don't know how familiar you are with this particular theory Ted has, that we should redate the Exodus sort of events to 1446 BC, the time that Amenhotep II. Presumably you believe that it's traditionally associated, as most scholars say, with Ramesses in 1200 BC.
Well, that's a long-standing debate. It's no new thing. There's, you look at old reference books, and they'll tell you that some think Moses was about 1450, some say 1250, and it's generally been thought there's no way to determine it. But, of course, I think that this is like Plutarch and Herodotus trying to locate Hercules in history. Good luck. This idea that the thing with Amenhotep and so on, to go from something to the plagues of Exodus is a wild leap. It's almost like when people say, boy, how could they have built the pyramids? Oh, must have been flying saucers with tractor beams. I mean, you can just say anything you want if you're trying to answer, fill in a blank with another blank. boy, if this happened, it sure would fit, but there's loads of ways, mundane ways to explain these things. I just cannot believe the utter disregard of what Wellhausen and today Thompson and Lemke say. I can't believe that you're really even familiar with their work, because if so, you're just grossly distorting it. And it seems clear you're just reaching for anything that would establish the narrative of a guy changing a stick into a snake and so forth. It's just hard to take it seriously.
So basically, we're coming back to the claim Bob made right at the outset here, Ted, that you're involved in the kind of archaeology that's about actually a predetermined agenda to make the narrative fit the Bible. It's apologetics dressed up as history. Okay, I mean, you might want to respond to that general accusation, but why do you think it does make sense to read into these events of Amenhotep the biblical story of the Exodus, and rather than any other mundane explanation that might explain why these things we find these things archaeologically?
Well, as I've said, archaeology is not 100%. It's a cumulative case. And it's not like, you know, in this discussion that we're having today, we're just sort of hitting around in bits and pieces. And I would say that the case for the Exodus and the case for Moses is a comprehensive case, and we're just touching on little small parts here and there. So if you were to look at the case altogether, I think it would make much more sense. But I would just say, you know, the starting point is give the text the benefit of the doubt. And that's where I think Bob and I disagree, because he sort of practices something called I think I've read this somewhere, I forgot who said it, but it's the hermeneutics of suspicion. I think maybe Kenneth Kitchen said that. But there's just an immediate distrust of the text from the outset without letting the text actually speak for itself. Why is that? I don't understand why you would not give the text benefit of the doubt. So I would say, again, it's the cumulative case. And as far as apologetics goes, the same can be said for those who want to sort of disprove the biblical text as well. I mean, as if people don't have presuppositions, as if Bob doesn't is completely objective in everything that he looks at in the text.
Bob, do you want you? It sounds like Bob wants to come in on that. Bob, go ahead.
And this is just a bunch of slander. Collingwood in The Idea of History explains how a modern historian, as opposed to an ancient scissors and paste historian, does not regard any text as an authority right off the bat. Rather, you have to put it on the stand and cross-examine it. The authority is the historian, and of course he can never come up with absolutely definitive conclusions. It's all provisional, but you can't just assume innocent until proven guilty, and this is with any text, not just the Bible, and it has nothing to do with trying to debunk the Bible.
Okay, go ahead.
I'd like to ask Bob a question.
Go ahead.
Bob, just a very general question. How do we know history at all?
Well, we don't know it definitively, but we have to compare what evidence we have. We have to see if there is any confirmation of it from other sources that seem unrelated. It does not involve is any kind of religious, quasi-religious or anti-religious presuppositions about what can and cannot happen. It's based on the several principles that Trelsch enunciated well, one of them being the principle of analogy, that if you have a story that is not paralleled by anything anyone alive today has ever seen, but it does look an awful lot like what everyone recognizes as ancient myths, what are you going to conclude? Well, you weren't there, you don't know, but all you can do is render a tentative verdict of not probable. And it seems to me that the whole thing with the Moses and the Exodus is grossly improbable.
Okay.
I love the stories. They're great, but it doesn't involve some blanket denial of miracles or God. How do I know whether there's...
Okay.
You know, I don't...
Well, it's good for you to we're good for you to clear that up for us, Bob. But carry on, Ted, from where you were, because, I mean, obviously, in your view, it cuts both ways, this criticism about the apologetics. Bob disagrees. I mean, coming to that question, though, of why we should, you know, put the events of Exodus onto these historical findings about Amenhotep, you know, why not another explanation? Are you kind of forcing it to fit your preferred narrative?
Right. I mean, it's possible that it could be another explanation for it. But I mean, I'm just giving the benefit of the doubt, the text, and seeing, you know, what does the text say, and looking at the internal evidence in the text itself. For example, the text that I mentioned earlier in 1 Kings chapter 6, verse 1, and then also building the case positively by using a historical synchronism, which is the building of Solomon's temple in 966 BC. So when we do that, we're not talking about conjecture here. We're not pulling something ad hoc. We're looking at internal evidence in the text itself, which you know, it may or may not be a historical text, but at least give it the benefit of the doubt and follow it out to see where it leads. And this is what you find. And you find consistency in the Egyptian record, and in specifically in the reign of Amenhotep II. Now, I didn't just pull his name out of a hat, but that's where he comes from. He comes from chronology, and it comes from a historical synchronism.
And as far as you can see, the other Egyptians that, you know, you could pick out of the hat, as it were, the other Egyptian rulers, they don't have any equivalent episodes in their archaeological history that would cohere in the same way that his does with the Moses story.
Correct. Not as much. There are a few who have some similarities. Some people have tried to make the connection with Akhenaten, who'd said that, you know, well, monotheism came from Akhenaten, but the chronology doesn't fit.
Okay.
And there's a lot of other things that don't fit as well.
Before we come back to Bob, and we are in the last few minutes really here, and I'm going to be opening up a huge area, really. We won't do it justice. But you talk about a cumulative case, and you also make the case that if there was an Egyptian exodus, then we would expect to find military conquest four decades later into the Levant, you know, in terms of the you know, as they move through to the Promised Land and so on. And you claim we do find that. So is that, again, part of your cumulative case for the historical case for the Exodus?
Yes, absolutely. In fact, when I taught Old Testament, I would always tell my students that the Exodus and conquest stand or fall together. And if it is the case, if I'm correct, or if, and I'm not the only one who holds this, this is a position from some of my colleagues as well, Dr. Eugene Merrill at Dallas Seminary, as well as Scott Stripling and Dr. Bryant Wood at Associates for Biblical Research. So if we are correct about the dating of this, then we're also going to see a conquest in the Holy Land, and that's exactly what we find. And if you read the text carefully in the conquest narratives, the text tells us that there are only three cities that were definitively taken by Joshua and the Israelites, and the first one was Jericho, the third one is Ai, and the fourth one is a place called Hazor. And I've actually excavated an Ai, and we do find definitive evidence in about 1401, 1406 BC. With the case of Jericho, Jericho was originally excavated in the 1930s by John Garstang from the University of Chicago. Actually, Garstang was British, but he worked with the University of Chicago. And he did find a destruction layer at City 4 at Jericho, which coincides exactly, identically with what we find in the text. In fact, to a T. In fact, the archaeology actually provides illumination to the biblical text itself. The Bible says in Joshua that the walls, when they fell from Jericho, the Hebrew says they fell beneath themselves. And in City 4, what we find at Jericho is that there were actually two parts of the wall. There was an upper wall and a lower wall, a revetment wall, and some kind of earthquake or something happened in which the outer wall fell and formed a ramp up into the city. And the city was burned exactly as the biblical record says.
So for you, as I say, this is cumulatively, you've got, as far as you're concerned, this evidence for Amenhotep II being the time we should date this. We've got then the events in Amenhotep II's reign that seem to cohere. And then 40 years later, you've got very specific things that seem to match the biblical account of the conquest and so on. So for you, that all builds towards the credibility of this case. Bob, I feel we should bring you in. We are heading towards the end here now. Is this all for you just kind of, you know, post hoc, you know, rationalizations and fitting his story? Go on.
It's not quite right to say you should give the text the benefit of the doubt. What you're doing is giving the text the benefit of faith in the doctrine of inerrancy. It's obvious to an outsider what you're doing is completely circular to go with biblical chronology, which is just the pointed issue. I mean, there's real reason to doubt that Solomon and the temple ever existed, but no, we take that for granted. Well, and then certain things follow like a row of dominoes, but you have to start way back before you start. And you're living in a different universe of Old Testament scholarship. It's obviously just warmed over apologetics.
Okay. This is has been a repeated criticism of you throughout the program, Ted. I mean, for you, why is this not reheated apologetics? Would you be open, you know, and let's be honest here, if you found evidence that completely contradicted the biblical story, would you just have to say, yeah, that's it? Or does your belief in, you know, the Old Testament scriptures kind of come before your archaeology, which is, I think, is what Bob is accusing you of?
Yes, and I do appreciate it, and I actually agree with him on that point. And the fact that a lot of archaeology started out as apologetically related, and I don't see a problem with that. Methodologically, though, I am a theist. I mean, I do believe that the universe is, of course, created by a theistic God. So, yes, that does figure into it. But I don't think you necessarily have to be an inerrantist to give the text the benefit of the doubt. I think that's actually just a false dichotomy to say that you have to be an inerrantist to give the text the benefit of the doubt. You know, Michael Wood, who is a British historian, did some work on the story of the Iliad, the Odyssey, as well as, of course, before him, Heinrich Schliemann as well, and found that there was historical kernel of truth to the stories of the Iliad, the Odyssey, although, of course, the gods didn't exist. But there is a historical kernel of truth to the story of the Iliad and the Odyssey and many other ancient texts as well. So I just think it's just wrong to say that you have to be an inerrantist to give
And
the
do you think scholars like Bob, and there are, you know, scholars here in the UK that I could mention who take a very skeptical view of the Old Testament, do you think they are equally kind of, you seem to have made that case sort of at pains to try and disprove the biblical accounts.
Yes, they do. And what I just find it fascinating why what their motivation is. I don't understand what the motivation is to try to make it a point to disprove the text, or to say that, in fact, one of the archaeologists that I actually quoted in a paper that I wrote was an Israeli archaeologist who said the greatest sin in archaeology is to try to connect events of the Bible with actual historical events. And I'm like, why is that a sin? Will Herberg wrote many years ago in the Christian Scholars Review, he talked about the scandal of the Christian faith. And this is kind of my position. I think this is probably the polar opposite of Bob. He appreciates the Bible, and he said he loves the Bible, in which I'm glad. That's great. But my point is, and I think the point of Herberg's quote, is that the scandal of the Christian faith is that we actually believe that these things actually happened. It's not just that they make us feel good and they give us some kind of, you know, warm, fuzzy feelings inside, but we actually believe that they really did happen. And so if we're going to say that about the New Testament, we're also going to say that about the Old Testament. You know, is that a theological belief? Yes. But I believe it can also be supported by good, solid historical and archaeological research that has nothing to do necessarily with theism or any kind of philosophical positions.
We're going to leave it there from you. Thank you very much, Ted, for being with us. Bob, thank you for being with us as well. If people want to find out more about this, they can find out in your book, can't they? Holy Fable, the Old Testament Undistorted by Faith. But I do appreciate you being on the program today, Bob.
Thanks for having me.
It's been great to have you. Ted, also, thanks for a fascinating discussion today. We're out of time. It's gone by too quickly. There was so much more as well we were trying to get to in today's show, but maybe we'll leave it for another time. Look forward to hearing your responses, of course, to this. I'm sure there'll be many coming in the mailbag. I'll give the ways to get in touch in a moment's time. But for now, my thanks to Ted Wright, epicarchaeology.org, for his website. And Bob Price can be found at robertmprice.mindvendor.com. Links to them both, of course, from today's show, which you can find at premierchristianradio.com/unbelievable.
Unbelievable with Justin Brierley.
Hope you enjoyed today's programme. As ever, you can email in unbelievable@premier.org.uk. Share your thoughts with me and I'll try and read out as many as I can. At UnbelievableJB if you'd like to share them via Twitter, and facebook.com/UnbelievableJB to like the Facebook page of the show and see what I post up there on a regular basis. Just a quick mention of the magazine I also edit. I do the radio half of my time and I'm editing a magazine the other half of my time here at Premier, and it's Premier Christianity Magazine monthly title. Got a fantastic August edition out right now, and actually being distributed a number of festivals, including Creation Fest this year. If you'd like to get hold of a copy though, and you live in the UK, do simply ask for one. premierchristianity.com/free sample, and we'd be delighted to send you a copy of the latest magazine. Some really interesting stuff in there. Thanks to all those who have been sending in their feedback. A few more reviews landing on Amazon for Unbelievable the book. Really encouraging to see the way both Christians and non-Christians have actually been reacting to the book and responding to it. If you want to check out the book for yourself, download the first chapter for free, find out more about it, and indeed get yourself a signed copy of the book, which we're now making available through our website. Do go to unbelievablebook.co.uk. I was able to record an edition of Stand to Reason earlier in the week that I think will air towards the end of August. So that's great fun with Greg Kokel and the team at Stand to Reason. And still having a bit of a backpatting session as well from all the lovely feedback that came in after I put out a call for a competition to win some signed copies of the book. And the various people who entered that left all kinds of lovely comments alongside their entries about why they listened to the show. Some of these messages are so lovely. They've been really touching. John said, "I was an atheist. I didn't start listening to the podcast until after I became a Christian, but I enjoy listening to both sides of the argument because I can relate to both. Lance says, I started listening about 4 years ago. I was looking up apologetics debates in podcasts and Unbelievable was one of the first to pop up. The show's been a great asset and a learning platform for me. Love what you're doing. John says, I enjoy listening to Unbelievable. It takes me out of my echo chamber. I see that there are rational, intelligent people with different views to me who often make good challenges to my existing worldview. Justin does a great job at being a fair, friendly host. Darcy begins by saying, Aloha. I don't know whether that means you are from Hawaii, Darcy, but you say, I've been listening to Unbelievable since 2010. It's become an integral in my faith journey. The program has become a staple in my life. I came to know Jesus about 10 years ago, rather late, my mid-30s, and unlearning my atheistic worldview hasn't always been easy, but Unbelievable has truly helped shape my new biblical understanding. And yet I'm often here my old self and can sympathize with the atheists and agnostics on the show. I love how the program has changed over the years, how many more listeners there are from all over the world, and love the trajectory on which the Lord has taken Justin as well. I'm wonderfully pleased as his being a published author. All this to say, well done, Justin. Eagerly await the next 10 years. Thank you so much, Darcy. Susan says, Unbelievable challenges me, stretches my thinking, comforts and informs me. It also models love, understanding and respect where there are differences. I live in Brisbane, Australia. Every weekend, I play the programme and soak it up. Thank you for the show. Vidar says, listening to Unbelievable has become my weekly rhythm. As everyone else has said, Justin's warm, respectful style and delightful British accent keeps things enjoyable show after show. And as for the guests, I really appreciate the variety of personalities and discussions. As a Christian, it gives me hope that there are actually deeply thinking believers out there that without a doubt have kept and expanded their faith whilst thinking about everything between heaven and earth. Greetings from Norway. Thank you, Vidar. David lives in the USA. He says, there usually is mostly one-sided or biased or propagandized views. I came across your show listening to Stephen Meyer, an intelligent design advocate, debating Peter Atkins. Your show was profoundly unique. It shook a lot of views and the ground I stood on. I continue to then, over the course of time, listen to many of the abundant episodes you've made available. Justin's show opened my mind to various views and to not feel intimidated. It's taught me, if anything, how to think rather than what to think. Through much of the various debates and subjects I listened, I came out a believing Christian. I am more enlightened and in tune with worldly views and even Christian views. Love England and its people, and I love Unbelievable. Thank you, Justin and the staff, for all the hard work. Peter says, as a Christian at a small church, I value the range of discussion. Andy says, Unbelievable has for 10 years been a reference point for apologetic studies. Monica says, I live in Sweden. I listen to the Nomad podcast, enjoyed the interview with Justin, and started to listen to Unbelievable. So you're a fairly recent listener to the programme, Monica, then. And John says, fascinated atheist listener. Here's to another decade. Lovely. Thank you so much. That's, again, I'm just working my way through a lot of comments that came in. Have we time for some actual feedback to recent programmes? Let's try and squeeze some in. We've had a couple of shows on science and faith. Firstly, Alistair McGrath in conversation with Colin Blakemore about sort of meaning and purpose in the universe. And then, of course, last week's show, a conversation between three physicists, two of them believers, one an agnostic. So Jonathan Davies says, I was raised by an atheist stepdad and agnostic mum. Aged 40 years, I became a follower of Jesus, formerly an agnostic. That was 11 years ago. Before I accepted the world I grew up in as the only one, about 10 years ago, I became a young earth creationist. Before that, I was gap theory. Before that, evolutionist. My faith has changed me. I believe in questioning the worldview I was originally taught, seeing that the world is not right, that the fall of man has made things a lot worse than God's perfect creation. Observational science can only see things as they are today. Historical science, questions about how the earth has changed, how life has changed, rely on speculation. We really know a lot less as humans than we make out. Randolph says, I very much enjoy and appreciate Unbelievable. The discussion between McGrath and Blakemore was interesting, but I was surprised that no one mentioned the giants of science like Newton, Pascal, Copernicus and Galileo, through their pursuit of science to explain the universe, actually gave them an enhanced appreciation for the Christian God and his marvellous creation. Well, we did cover that a little more, I think you'd agree, Randolph, in the second show, where we had Susie Sheehy in conversation with David Hutchings and Tom McLeish, the authors of that book, Let There Be Science. This one from Andy Wyant says, I've been an avid listener of the show, one of the biggest fans in the USA. Tell everyone I can about Unbelievable. You have the perfect mix. Some thoughts, though, on whether science needs God from last week. I'm both a scientist, a physician and professor of physiology and medicine at the University of Kentucky, and a pastor of a rural church in Kentucky. I also host a show, God Talk, regarding issues of faith, science and metaphysics. So this is one of my favourite topics. I was an atheist until 2005, when I was forced to wrestle with the big questions of meaning and purpose. And after a serious study, including a divinity degree, I found the question of God's existence to be weighed towards the affirmative. At the end of the day, I found all the apologetic arguments to at least bring me to an epistemological 51% in favour of a divine mind. Although I am a Christian pastor, I still have questions about the character and nature of God, and I'm unsure how much we can know about the divine even with revelation. But I'm not agnostic about his being. I wish the authors David and Tom could have gone deeper into their specific thesis for how science and faith coexist, but I agree with their foundation that the intelligibility of the universe, scientific method, mathematical axioms, and the knowable nature is far more consistent with a divine mind than a random, unguided process. It seemed to me Susie, the agnostic, was confusing ontology with epistemology. Certainly there is no theistic advantage or requirement to study, learn, or do science, but the author's point seemed to me was that there would be no scientific endeavour at all were there not a lawgiver in the ontological sense. Her reply about other world religions, again, is a question about how much or if humanity can know God rightly or at all. But this has no bearing on the actual existence of a creator God behind it all. As a physicist, I would like to get her take on the cosmological argument and how she explains the beginning of the universe from an atheist perspective. As always, a phenomenal show, but all too brief. I wish you'd consider going to 2 hours a week for Unbelievable. Thank you, Andy. Who knows? Maybe if the powers that be give me double the length of time, that could happen. As it stands, I hope that the hour and a bit that you do get each week satisfies you. Thank you for listening. Thank you for your feedback. And thank you for being with me on the show today. If you're sticking with us here on Premier Christian Radio, though, a great edition of The Profile coming up. Reverend Rose Hudson-Wilkin, chaplain to the Speaker of the House of Parliament and the most senior black clergywoman in the Church of England, is talking to Katie Stock on the programme. You can download it as a podcast, by the way, if that piques your interest. Just look it up on your podcast provider, The Profile by Premier Christian Radio. But in the meantime, thanks for being with me. Let me tell you what's coming up next week.
You're unbelievable.
We'll be broadcasting from Creation Fest on next week's show. Yes, you're going to be hearing the discussion I'm going to be having on stage with Andy Bannister, Christian theologian and apologist, and Mark Preedy of Cornwall Humanist. Why I'm a Christian, why I am a humanist, in front of a live audience. Should be a lot of fun. Hope you can join me for the broadcast of that at the same time next Saturday. For the moment, thanks for being with me and see you next time.